Hello and welcome to I Am The Egg Pod with me, Chris Shaw. Throughout January 2022, a potpourri of delicious guests are taking a jaunty stroll through Peter Jackson's Get Back, day by day, every day, on the day. In this episode, I'm joined by stand-up comedian, broadcaster, podcaster, and actor, Ellis James. Hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine, how are you?
I'm really, really good, actually. I'm delighted to have been asked to do this, because when the trailer was first released, I then thought about Get Back every single day until its release on, was it November the 25th? So I'm immensely honoured that you've asked me to do this. And I watched it anyway when it went out. And then when I was asked to do the podcast, I got to watch episode one again for work, which was very exciting. Because, I mean, I've got lots and lots of thoughts on how good it is. But I don't know if it's the same for you, but the anthology is probably the most formative TV watching experience of my life, I think. Mm. So that came out in November, the end of November 1995, so I just turned 15. And then this came out in at the end of November 2021, so I just turned 41. And I think the anthology was, obviously I was aware of their music, but it's the best introduction to their story. The TV cut of that documentary is just such a fantastic introduction to their story. And I think the Get Back, I've talked to lots of people online who've said, oh, you know, I didn't really know much about the Beatles story. My mum and dad had the records, I'd heard the songs, but I love this. I do think that it does benefit if you know the story. I think you get more out of it. But there are clearly plenty of people enjoying it almost, you know, or enjoying them for the first time. But the thing that I finally got out of this, which I realised was the thing I'd always wanted. So, you know, unlike some of your guests, I'm not a Beatles expert. I'm just a huge fan and I've read lots of the books. So I read, you know, Beatles 66 this year and 1, 2, 3, 4, and I reread the Hunter Davis one, the Beatles, the authorised biography. And I realise in those books, my favourite bits are any kind of reported conversation from them when they've just been themselves away from, you know, away from a more formal sort of interview setting. And obviously, the problem with, you know, as someone who's read lots of books on the Beatles, the problem with any kind of biography is reported speech from 50 years ago is slightly dodgy anyway, but I'll take it. give it to me. So stuff like Beatles 66 or 1, 2, 3, 4, I'm only mentioning these because these are the books I've read most recently. You know, there'll be something that Lennon said to Mick Jagger in the Scotch of St. James nightclub or the Ad Lib nightclub. And even though it's 55 years ago, I'm like, this is the stuff I want. And finally, we've got hours of it. And, you know, literally hours of it. And because, as someone who does lots of podcasts and radio shows, before I had my own radio show, I would go on radio to promote a stand-up gig or something. And you can put on, you can put on an act for 10 minutes to promote your show, or when I was, on the occasions I was interviewed, you put on a little bit of an act. But when you're on a radio show for 3 hours, in my case, my sort of best mate, you can't put on an act because it's just too long. You can't put on an act for 3 hours a day, once a week. And so with the Beatles, even though obviously they're aware they're being filmed, what I loved about Get Back is I think they do kind of forget because they're too honest. And, you know, they argue too much and that kind of stuff. And I think that if it was a more formal thing, they'd be on their best behaviour. And obviously that comes to an extent because when they invite Billy Preston into the band, what is effectively listening to like a 1960s proto-podcast, just mates chatting, is even if you don't like the music, fascinating as a sort of document of social history. But as someone who's obsessed with the band, I just could not get enough of it. I honestly watched all 8 hours or whatever it is, just with my mouth open, not being able to believe what I was seeing. And I think it scratched an itch that I hadn't realised it existed for 25 years. And also, I don't know what you think. Having read the books, I thought that by 1969 they hated each other's guts, really, and that they, especially John and Paul.
Yeah.
And it's sort of a love story, I think, between John and Paul. They still look to each other for validation and for recognition. And I can see how George must have felt sidelined by it all. But I do think that if the Alan Klein thing and money and stuff and contracts hadn't got in the way, there was definitely more to come from that relationship. I don't think that musically they'd run out of steam. I think it was other stuff, sadly.
So, we're talking about Friday the 10th of January. This is day 7. And it starts pretty well with some pantomime booze. Because we've got music publisher Dick James, who's showing Ringo and Paul a list of 4,000 songs that Northern Songs have just bought. His quote was that the sheet music is an expanding market.
Yeah. Which, again, I think it helps if you know the Beatles story, because you can go, oh, God, they fell out! He's one of the reasons that for some reason Michael Jackson owns all the Beatles songs!
Well, it was literally a couple of months later, but when John and Yoko and Paul and Linda were actually on honeymoon, that Dick James sold off his rights. You know, he sold off his shares to Lou Grade.
And it was lovely to put a face to the name. Because I'd read his name so many times and I had no idea what he looked like. But I also love, were I to meet Peter Jackson, I would say, obviously, it's great that you've had all of them rehearsing, all of the different versions of songs, them doing songs, you know, like they're ventriloquists or in exaggerated Scouse accents. That's great. But my favourite bits of the whole thing are them sitting around and talking. Mm. And I would watch 8 hours of that. I would watch all 60 hours of it, if I'm honest. But so them sitting around before they've really started work and Dick James is talking about their career. And McCartney's, he notices that there's a song that his Uncle Ron likes. Carolina Moon, is that what it's called?
Yes.
And he's and then
his Uncle Ron's favourite.
Yeah, and then he does an impression of his Uncle Ron. And to me, that is absolute... It's gold dust.
Yeah. Because Dick James is basically, he's giving them all the songs that they now, or Northern Songs officially own. And you've got things like Anyone Could Be a Millionaire, Don't Go Down the Mine, Daddy, and Nobody Loves a Fairy When She's 40.
Oh my God.
But Paul, his face lights up. First of all, he notices Ain't She Sweet.
Yeah.
They now own. But yeah, when he sees Carolina Moon. And he does him, and you're there, aren't you, with his with the McCartney family at Christmas?
Yeah,
doing all these songs.
And I think what I noticed watching it as a Welsh person, as a sort of West Walian person who now no longer lives in West Wales, when I'm with my West Walian mates, we do like exaggerated Welsh accents, and we pretend to be people that we grew up with or people from school. That's very common. And the Beatles, obviously, they don't live in Liverpool anymore. And they do exactly the same thing. And also, when they play standards, or sort of rock and roll standards, which they refer to as golden oldies, you know, things like Chuck Berry songs, which are now part of the canon of rock and roll, and some of those songs are 60 years old. They're only 11 years old, really, some of them, by this stage.
I know.
And they talk about things like Hamburg or Playing in the Cavern. And in Beatles terms, Hamburg to Twickenham, where they're recording these songs, is a century. But actually, it's like 8 years or something.
I know.
And it's like me talking about the 2013 Edinburgh Festival. It's like that. It's yesterday. And when they're talking about the quality of the PA, you know, for doing a TV, for the TV show that's going to end the documentary, they're still talking about the PA they had in Hamburg or the PA they had in the Cavern. Mm. These are their references. Yeah. And I mean, if you're ever worried that you've wasted your life, do not Google their ages during this, because it is... Harrison is 25! Oh, my God!
Please don't do that.
Yeah, Michael Lindsay-Hogg says, yeah, you know, well, we don't want to do that. We're all 28 now. And they're like, yeah, we are. Yeah. We're all 28 now. 28? my God.
Well, I don't know about you. I know you're a big Beatles fan, but back in the day, there are lots of bootlegs floating about with all the Get Back sessions going on.
Yeah.
And you hear Michael Lindsay Hogg and you think he sounds about like mid-50s. Whatever. Yeah. And,
yeah, he's 28 as well.
Yeah. Don't get me onto the policeman in the rooftop session.
What?
They look so young.
Ray Daggs so young. And, was it Ray Shaler?
Yes.
PC Ray Dagg. Well, I mean, he doesn't look old enough to be a copper. Ray Dagg. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. Also, I think somebody needs to get put to bed. There's no way Mal Evans is 6'6". He's clearly a big bloke. I've read, I think on his Wikipedia page it says he's 6'6". I find that difficult to believe.
He's a big guy.
I think he's one of the people who comes out this the best, actually. He's constantly adorable, yes. Mal.
You compare this to the original Let It Be. The Let It Be film was basically the four of them and Yoko.
Yeah.
And that was it. But through the Peter Jackson, we meet all these different people, yeah, and we get to know them. Like
Kevin Harrington. Johns,
Kevin.
With his buttoned-up Fred Perry, which I actually paused to check that out. I wanted to see what shoes he was wearing.
And do you know what song Kevin sings on, Beatles song?
No, I don't, actually.
Bungalow Bill.
Does he?
He does. And you can hear him. Or he claims he can hear himself. He's the one singing an octave lower. So when they're going, hey, Bungalow Bill, he's going, hey,
Buffalo. All right.
That's Kevin.
I did not know that.
But there's all these different characters that if they put that in the original film, it would have made it such a more... So many people on social media have fallen in love with Kevin Harrington at the moment.
And he's 19. Which is absolutely terrifying. And I read an interview with him. He worked with them for 2 years, I think, between sort of 68 and 69. And yeah, what an amazing thing to do when you're that age.
He later went on to work with Dave Stewart and Annie Lennox.
Yes, he did, yeah.
As the Tourists, not as the Eurythmics. And that's how he found out. I think he'd been touring with them. And they came back, and that's where he found out John had died. And he was saying he bawled his eyes out.
They
finished the tour. Bless his heart.
Yeah.
Because he's adorable in this, isn't he? He's so lovely.
So, Mal, because you see less of Neil Aspinall than I would have expected, because...
I guess a lot of it's editing, isn't it? And I guess Neil was always in the background anyway. He wasn't a camera hogger, ever. Really?
No.
You look at the press conferences.
It's just I don't think I'd... Because Neil, obviously Mal had died by the time they made the anthology, but you know Neil is interviewed a lot on the anthology. I'd never seen an interview with Mal. I certainly don't think I had anyway. But there's the bit when he plays the hammer, the anvil on Maxwell's Silver Hammer.
Yeah.
And he just looks absolutely delighted. And that was my favourite sort of... screenshot of the whole thing until I saw someone screenshotted it and put it on Twitter. There's the bit on the roof during the rooftop concert where McCartney turns around and realizes that the police have turned up, and then he turns back to his microphone to continue singing, and he's got this look of complete glee on his face.
Yeah.
And he's like, we're gonna get nicked. What a fantastic ending this is going to be. Incredible.
He's elated, isn't he?
Yeah.
So we're still here and Dick James is still bleating away. And they're talking about all the songs that they now own, or Northern Song Zone. Dick James kind of throws out, we've got all these songs, and also we've obviously got Paul and John's. And Paul says, well, just about. And Dick James genuinely looks angry. So what are you talking about, just about? And it's a really awkward moment where Paul says, oh, nothing, no comment. And I wonder if that was... I mean, John did make some comments after that about businessmen and whatever. I think that was possibly a point where Dick James was thinking, I'm out of here.
Yeah. The thing with the business side of the Beatles, it's the attitude... I think to Brian Epstein has changed a little bit over the last few years, because certainly when I used to read books in the 90s, when I was really getting into the Beatles as a teenager, some of his quite naive financial dealings were quite heavily criticised. But then I think what people are coming round to now is that you can't be a record shop owner in Liverpool, which is what he was, own, you know, manage the 20th century's biggest cultural phenomenon, certainly pop cultural phenomenon, you know, biggest band of all time. Have other acts as well, because obviously he didn't just manage the Beatles, he managed other people, you know, people like Silla, and kind of create modern management at the same time, whilst all of this is going on. So I've read lots of things that are very critical of some of his more naive financial dealings. But now, I'm, you know, he'd never even done it before. He was also learning on the job. That's sort of another, it's another thing people forget. You know, it's not like he'd managed, you know, Billy Fury and people like that, or some the 50s stable. It's not like he'd managed Lonnie Donegan. He was a record shop owner, and then he started managing the Beatles, and he's trying to do all of this at once, which must have been immensely stressful.
So you think he's against people like Larry Parnes?
Yes, yeah, yeah. Who stable were very of stars, kind of
savvy. They knew what they were doing, and they must have seen him coming, because they're dealing with people like Larry Parnes, and he must have come across as naive, I think.
Yeah, there's the story. I read all of David Hepworth's books over the summer, and there's a story, I can't remember which David Hepworth book it is, but he talks about how on a flight back from America, Epstein's delighted because he's made this deal. I think from memory, I think it's $100,000, a sort of a buyout for T-shirts. And he's like, this is great, because he's comparing it to the English market. And kind of hasn't realised that America was a country of 250 million people. And then someone tells him that they already had 1 million pre-sales already. And he's like, yeah. Oh, God. His blood runs cold. And that must be very, very frustrating, I think, if you're in the Beatles, even though they were, you know, rich by anyone's standards, to think that someone else is getting rich because of a mistake that somebody else made on your behalf. That must be quite frustrating. So I can see, I can see how, you know, there could be some bitterness there. But I mean, my God, if I'd been manager of the Beatles in 1965, it would have been far, far, far worse.
I do.
I'm from the take the first offer school of negotiation. We'll take it.
That's why I've still got 50 years to go on my mortgage.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But there was somebody.
Come on, lads, they're offering you 40 quid here.
I mean, you see it in this film. And again, going back to Kevin Harrington, he said it in an interview that what a closed shop they were, even back in 68 when he first started working with them. To this day, you know, they resent. They were ripped off so many times. With Brian Epstein, I think it's a different matter. I think it's pure naivety.
Yes.
Nobody could have dealt with that situation.
No, no. Because they were breaking new ground in every possible way. So the amount of firsts that they're responsible for, the amount of templates they set, you think, well, that person doesn't exist. Who's like, okay, well, we'll get the best possible deal from this, and you know. There's the bit, I think, in episode 3 where John is off to meet Alan Klein, and he's already met him in the Rolling Stones Rock and Roll Circus, and he's talking about how great this guy is. Yeah. Oh, you've got to meet him. You've got to meet him. And I think it's Glyn Johns who says, I'm not so sure about him. And you want to go, tell him, Glyn!
Well, Glyn, I think, comes at so well in this as well, because when Dick James is there, he seems such a good judge of character.
Yeah.
Because Dick James and Glyn saying, well, yeah, and actually, nah, sheet music, nah, a lot of it's wrong.
Yeah.
You put the wrong chords down. And he looks really cynical, and Glyn seems so savvy, and you're so glad to have him there, and you just think, just listen to Glyn.
Yeah, yeah. And those that sheet music and those chord books were wrong when I was learning the guitar in the 90s. And you'd play it and you'd think, that's not right. I've got there's a Who songbook from the 70s where Pete Townsend's actually written the chord boxes out himself, because he's like, I think he must have been just sick really? That people kept transcribing them incorrectly.
Because George then arrives, and it's another of many awkward moments in this film where Ringo says to him, George, would you like to see what you've got half a percentage of? And she's like, not really.
Yeah.
And it's, oh, you can't blame them. And we've also got Vera Lynn has done a double A side of Good Night and Fool on the Hill.
Which I'd Dick never James heard.
No. Has anybody?
She was quite big. She was a big name in the, well, maybe not as much by the late 60s. I don't know. But Lennon seems delighted that Vera Lynn's performed their songs.
Well, I suppose it's a big name, isn't it? I suppose it's like someone saying Madonna's going to do a version of you and me doing this podcast.
I mean, that's the only time Vera Lynn's ever been compared to Madonna. That's a world first. It's like the feedback on I'll Feel Fine. No one's done that before. No one's ever... No one's ever compared Vera Lynn to Madonna.
But yeah, she's going to perform it on the Rolf Harris show.
Apparently. Yeah.
So thankfully we don't get to see that. And then Dick says his goodbyes and no one really seems to care. But then we get Glyn Johns, who, I mean, a few people have said this on this little project, but he is like a peacock. He's a popinjay.
Tremendously well-dressed man. I mean, I couldn't get away with it, but I'm glad that he could. During the trailer, when the trailer was first released, I went through it frame by frame, pausing it on my phone because I was trying to work out what shoes the Beatles were wearing because I'm very interested in Beatles shoes. Mm. And Harrison's taste in footwear really does veer from the absolutely sublime to the totally ridiculous. He's wearing what looked like a pair of knitted boots at one stage.
There was one in particular, I swear it was Bungle from Rainbow. Yeah. That's all I saw on his feet.
Yeah.
So rehearsal starts. So they start doing Get Back, and it's a lovely, lovely little moment. You've got John and Paul, and they're face to face.
Yeah.
You know how they used to do it? They used to say they did the eyeball to eyeball thing. And they're, yeah, and Paul still hasn't got the words at this point. At this point, he's thinking, Get Back, how it should start. It should be a long bring, and then the drums kind of coming in. It amazes me because they go through all these different carnations of Get Back, but ultimately the one they eventually use is the one that he jammed in the beginning when he literally created the song.
And the thing I found really interesting about watching them come up with lyrics, they write their lyrics slightly differently to how I'd imagine. So Lennon especially, I assumed that he was writing lyrics in a sort of windowless garret with a paper and pencil and really agonising over every line. But I think that often if it sounds good and it serves the song, they would often go, all right, then let's go for that, because they had such a pop instinct. So Get Back, there's one, there's one incarnation where it's a protest song condemning Enoch Powell because Enoch Powell's in the news. But I think that there's a really sort of quite cruel comment from Lennon from the 70s, I think, where he said McCartney, it's something like, I'm paraphrasing, but he says something like McCartney is actually quite a good lyricist when he wants to be, but he doesn't realise that he has it, or he doesn't think he is, and so he doesn't go for it. And so, you know, they often, rather than sitting at a typewriter or with a paper and pen or paper and pencil, as I'd imagined, they play and then they just kind of freeform it. And obviously, Harrison's really struggling with the lyrics for something, and he messes about with the word pomegranate and cauliflower and that kind of stuff. But it seemed to be a more organic way of writing song lyrics than I'd assumed. And there's the bit in Don't Look Back, the Bob Dylan film, where he's writing at a typewriter like a novelist.
Yeah.
And I always assumed that certainly Lennon, it was a bit more like that. But I'm certainly, I mean, it might well have been in previous records or previous albums, but it doesn't seem to be like that this time round, where they're just, they're throwing ideas around, and if it sticks, it sticks.
The interplay is fascinating, I think, because you've got, it tends to be Paul that comes up with, he'll come up with something, and then John will throw in, no, change that to
yeah
something ultimately always better, it seems.
Yeah, and McCarthy, yeah.
John's very passive, I think, at this particular time. I don't know if that's how it was, but it is amazing to see them do it, because you are getting insight into them writing a Lennon-McCartney song.
Yeah, I mean, he had a drug problem, Lennon, during this period, so I don't know how that's changed things in comparison with earlier on in their careers, I should say. So, you know, cards on the table. I'm a huge, huge McCartney apologist. And I don't know if you like football, but I get very, very, very touchy if anyone criticises certain Welsh footballers. Aaron Ramsey in particular. Aaron Ramsey plays for Juventus. Like, he doesn't need me to fight his battles. But if someone criticises Aaron Ramsey, I'm like, whoa, hey, whoa, leave it. And I'm a bit like I'm a bit like that with Paul McCartney. Get Back obviously was trending, and I was looking at people I didn't necessarily follow on Twitter to see what they were saying about it. And a few people have said, well, McCartney's quite passive-aggressive, especially towards George. In his defence, certainly in the first week, they've got this insane deadline. This incredibly crazy deadline. So let's put this into some perspective. So they start on January the 2nd, don't they? They'd released the White Album on November the 22nd, which is a double album, lest we forget. And they're like, all right, so Ringo's he's in a film called The Magic Christian, but that's at the end of January. So we haven't got anything. Why do we write and record a brand new album from scratch before Ringo goes off and does his film? And obviously, that's a completely unmovable deadline, because film schedules are always very tight in lockdown. So let's see if we can do that. So then they've committed to it. Obviously, they're being filmed as well, which will add to the pressure. And I know that they seem to all get happier when they move into Savile Row. But my theory, having watched it back, is I think one of the things that makes them happier by the time they move to Savile Row, even though obviously the working conditions are nicer and it's a nicer place to be and the acoustics are better and all that kind of stuff, I think when you embark on any kind of creative project, whether it's writing a book or a stand-up show or an album or whatever, I think the first bit is the most stressful bit and the scariest bit, because you haven't got anything yet. You've just got a blank page and a flashing cursor on the screen. So I don't know if that's why they're getting at each other a little bit, because at one stage, quite early on, they say, well, we've only got four numbers and we haven't finished any of them. You're like, that must be absolutely terrifying. And they lose a couple of days because George leaves the band. I mean, my God. But McCartney, his creativity at this stage is just, it's absolutely astonishing, I think.
Yeah.
You know, to write Get Back more quickly than it takes to play. he's effectively done it in about 2 minutes.
I know.
And I think he must have, and you know, Harrison is clearly lacking in enthusiasm.
There's a lot of spikiness. I mean, one thing, you talk about their output, you forget 3 days after this, the day we're talking about, they released the Yellow Submarine album. Which nobody ever talks about.
Slow down. Give yourselves a break.
They're in here having little arguments, and meanwhile, we just release it some. But there's a point in here where it's the Hendrix chord, isn't it? The
one
that uses in Purple Haze. That Paul said, well, it's a bit passé now, we need to drop that. And George is, well, it's just a chord. And you get the sense it's not the chord, it's something much deeper that they're arguing about. And Paul's saying, you know, the chord's, it's good enough for rock and roll, and George says, well, you need Clapton then. And John jumps in, no, we need George Harrison.
Yeah.
And there's a lot going on there. And George's face is like thunder.
Harrison seems to have quite a inferiority complex in regards to Clapton. He more than once mentions Clapton as being more talented than him and being capable of doing stuff that he can't do. Harrison's technical virtuosity, or certainly in his opinion, lack of, was something I'd never really considered, because I think Harrison's a great guitarist. It never really occurred to me that he might look at some of the other guitarists of the period and think, oh, you know, they're good. And it's, I don't really want to think of the Beatles as being down on themselves in any way, really. I'm too protective over them. But Clapton is someone who does crop up quite a bit. More than anyone, it's not like they mention Jeff Beck or Keith Richards or Townsend or, you know, any of the other guitarists you would expect them to mention. It always seems to come back to Eric.
Yeah. So lyrically, John and Paul at this point are keen to continue with the anti-immigration lyrics. Paul and John are sort of working together and John's writing down the ideas. I don't know where Mal is because that's his job.
He's probably sourcing an anvil or something ridiculous. How could Mal do his job pre-Google? Imagine it's 1969 and someone has asked you to get an anvil. Without Googling it, how on earth do you go about doing that?
And he does it by the time they got back from lunch.
It's incredible. As an aside, I've been lucky enough to film quite a few things in Twickenham. And Studio One, where they are, it is identical. It has not changed at all. And you could, if you wanted to do some sort of serialised, dramatised version of this, with actors, a sort of modern-day version, you could go there and that's your set, because it is... Because Savile Row, where Apple, was, is now Abercrombie and Fitch. So the basement where they were rehearsing is now like a stock room, so it's full of T-shirts or something. But Twickenham, so I don't know how you do that. But Twickenham, it is almost chillingly similar. Because the first time I stood there, obviously I knew what it looked like because I'd seen Let It Be. I could not believe what I was seeing. Honestly, it's incredible.
So tell me then, since you've been there, because I think it's the first episode, day one of this, they're saying, this is a really bad place to do this. What is it that bad?
It's huge.
Very high ceilings.
And the ceiling's massive, yeah. Because those studios, I mean, it's been a film studio since the early 1900s. So they've made loads of stuff there. And obviously, depending on... I was in a couple of sitcoms that filmed there. So, for instance, I've been in there when they've turned it into like a young offenders unit, and I've been in there when they've turned it into a sort of a flat for 20-somethings. But those sets are relatively easy to sort out. But, if you were doing something far more ambitious in terms of the set, then you've got the room to do it. So it's absolutely huge. I don't know why they chose Twickenham, but it's massive. And
it was Dennis O'Dell because he was.
Oh, of course, yeah.
They were doing
because of the Magic Christian.
Magic Christian, yeah.
But it is
saving a bit of money.
But it hasn't changed. I can't emphasize that enough. If you want to reenact the argument they have, well, I'll play what you want me to play, or I won't play at all. You really can do that, and it will look exactly the same.
So, get back. We're still doing the lyrics. Paul's trying to get some names. He wants Jojo. He wants a Western name. So he's going through a whole range of surnames. So Jojo Perkins, Jojo Lennon, Jojo Carter, Williams, Braxton.
They all sound like people he'd have gone to school with rather than people who'd have fought in the colonial wars.
And John suggests changing it to Daphne. But he's convinced, no, it's Jojo. So Jojo Daphne, no.
Yeah.
And he was right, you know, it was going to be Jojo. And then it's slightly moves on, left his home in Arizona. So it's definitely getting there.
Lennon asks at one stage, he says, is Tucson definitely in Arizona? He does. Paul says, yes. And I was thinking, I was watching this and I thought, the incredible thing is, A, they couldn't Google it, and also, one of the ways they get so much done is no one's on their phones. So you see, occasionally, you'll see, Mal will be reading the Daily Mirror or something, but no one's just mindlessly scrolling through Twitter on their phones. Their version of procrastinating is to sing old songs in, like, exaggerated Cockney voices, which they do quite a lot of. Yeah. And that's McCartney's way of diffusing tension, which I find absolutely adorable.
I love the fact, his confidence in Tucson, yes, definitely, because Linda.
Oh, of course, yeah. And
sadly,
yeah.
That's where she died as well.
Right.
Which is like, you know, he still sings that song. It's like, oh, man.
Yeah.
But yeah, his confidence, he knows exactly where it is.
Yeah.
Bless him. Two of Us is next. And I think it sounds amazing, but they clearly think it needs more. George by now is looking thoroughly pissed off, I think. Now we get into it. John starts playing the riff of Talking About You, and Paul's trying to talk, and he says, John, could you just stop playing for a minute while I'm trying to talk to you about this arrangement? And John's like, yeah, all right, Paul.
I thought that was slightly more light-hearted, actually.
Well, thing is, as someone who's collected all these bootlegs over the years, what isn't in the film is that they go through Two of Us a lot. It's like countless times. It's a lot of times. And Paul is, he's really frustrated. And it's literally the point that they'll sing one line and then, no, not that, do that. And then they'll sing another, no, not do it. And it goes on and on. And you can hear George getting really frustrated. The tension is really, it's really palpable.
So you've taken it to the next level then. So you haven't just watched the original 1970 Let It Be. And you haven't just watched the 2021 Get Back. You've also listened to the bootlegs. So you're
thinking, sad is the word you're looking for.
Filling in the gaps by listening to the bootleg stuff that wasn't deemed worthy of an over an 8-hour documentary. Wow. I mean, I thought I liked the Beatles, but clearly not enough.
But it's at this point, I mean, the tensions have been rising. That's the thing that they do cut out. And I can kind of see why they did cut it out, because Paul is really harsh. He's really harsh on and George. Oh, okay, I'm trying. But he is really pushing it. So maybe that was why, I don't know.
Because McCartney said, doesn't he, that watching it back, obviously everyone's memory warps and distorts over 50 years. So McCartney watching it back, I think I read an interview with him where he said that he had bought into the Let It Be myth and that they were getting at each other all the time. Whereas I think, that in fact, certainly episodes 2 and 3, I think, of Get Back are actually quite joyful. I think they're getting on. I think my favourite, I mean, it will change as I watch and rewatch, but my favourite bit at the moment is after the rooftop gig, when they're back in the control room listening back. They're all absolutely buzzing because they haven't performed since 1966. And if you're performing four times a night, then the third gig of the on the Wednesday, you're probably not going to remember it unless something really, really memorable has happened. But if you haven't performed since 1966, or it would be like performing for the first time almost. And I think they're really together. So obviously, Maureen's there and Linda's there and Yoko's there. And they're tapping their feet and nodding their heads to their own music, which 3 weeks ago didn't exist, hadn't been written. And they've almost been arrested and they've performed in front of people in this impromptu sort of guerrilla gig. And Harrison's talking about the legality of it. I just think that is what Paul had always wanted to get back to, as them as a band. Mm. And he gets it. And obviously it's the last time they ever performed together. So I just think the final 10 minutes of episode 3 is just lovely.
It's nice to see a resolution to the tension that's here, at least. Obviously Paul is aware of it and he says, well, should we go to lunch? And then it's George, I think I'm leaving the band now. And then John's, when? George, now. And you're like, oh.
See you around the clubs.
Yeah. It cuts to then George. I think the video is different to the audio, actually, but George is talking to Mal Evans, and Mal Evans sounds stunned. And it's an amazing conversation. It's so grey.
Yeah.
George is saying, well, get a replacement, write to the enemy, get a few people. And Mal is clearly in shock. Well, I'll ask George Martin to see about paying residuals, and it's pure shock. But then there follows quite a lot of bravado. You know, George is saying, well, George Martin shouldn't be bothered about it. That's why we've got Apple, so that we can attend to it. And John's there and he said, well, we aim to please. you know, that it's so many emotions. It sounds really... And I think a lot of the books that I've been reading since I was a kid around this time saying, it's always the quote about John, oh, well, screw George, we'll just get Eric Clapton in. But there's, you see it now, and there's so much more to it. You can see that they're just trying to bluff it. They're trying to brave it out. Because they know they're being filmed. They're in front of cameras.
And, well, they ask the cameras to be turned off, don't they?
Yeah.
And also, there's the bit later on where Michael Lindsay-Hogg says, has anyone left before? And Lennon says, well, Ringo has. Which the story on the anthology as well makes me really sad because he just felt unappreciated. And, you know, for George to leave like that halfway through a project, it is a hammer blow. In terms of the shock, I think what really sums it up for me is then when they come back from lunch, they play these sort of proto-punk versions of the songs they've been working on. Really, really aggressive, heavily distorted versions. And Ringo plays like he's Keith Moon. And then, and they've all kind of gone a little bit mad. They're playing, and McCartney's just swinging from the scaffolding. And they've just gone a little bit nuts, I think, because, you know, he's their mate. McCartney's known him since school, since Harrison was about 13 or something, or 12 even. And, you know, he's gone. And it's over, they think. And it's quite a naked portrayal of shock. And I think because I've just watched episodes 2 and 3, which are more joyful, the way Disney Plus released Get Back, I watched episode 1 the night it came out. And at the end of it, because it's a cliffhanger, really, you know, George leaves the band. You know he comes back, but you don't know in what circumstances and you don't know what footage they're going to use and how those conversations are going to transpire and play out. I had my heart in my mouth. It's a really interesting snapshot of the mechanics of a band, I think.
Well, immediately they do the jam with Yoko. You end up with Paul on drums.
Yeah.
It's like sheer panic and we don't know what we're doing. And bless her, Yoko, you know, people have been, oh, listen to all that wailing and whatever. But I think she provided the perfect opportunity because all they wanted to do, it's Primal Scream.
Yeah, yeah.
It's before Plastic Ono Band. They needed to get it out somewhere. But it's that sort of bravado, you know, we'll get Eric in. And then you get Michael Lindsay-Hogg and he's talking to John. He's saying, you know, well, because he's clearly, you know, he's got a film to make. He's in the middle of a project, aside from all this. And he's saying, you know, can we just say George was sick?
Yes. Yeah, yeah. Which
is, and I do love Michael Lindsay-Hogg.
He's got bad tummy.
he's bloody eating stuff out.
We think it was the fish. Obviously, rice can be problematic when you reheat it.
But he does it all the way. And he said, well, what's the consensus? Do you want to go on with the show and the work? And this is where John says, you know, we'll get Clapton. So he's talking to Michael Lindsay-Hogg. He's just doing the bravado. He doesn't mean it. But for years, that's what we've heard in the books. And, that's when he says about, has anyone left? And he says, well, yeah, Ringo. But when he says, Ringo, it dawns on John. You can see in his face, there's kind of this pause of, yeah, Ringo. And it's he kind of realises, yeah, it's not just coincidence. It's all falling apart.
Yeah, yeah.
It's very moving, I think. But
They share a hug, don't they, the three of them?
Well, you've got... At this point, it's Maureen Starkey arrives, who is another one of those Kevin Harrington characters for me, because she is so 60s throughout of this. Every time Mo is there, she's dancing away and she's so into the music.
Yes, yes.
And then when she arrives, Paul jokes to her, just learn A7, D7, G7, get them off over the weekend and you're in. And it's that point where they're all sitting around desperate, really, and John's saying, so, cats and kittens, what are we going to do? And then no one has any ideas. They talk about Orson Welles, who was Michael Lindsay Hogg's father.
Yeah.
And John and Yoko are about to leave. And Paul gets a bit funny, and it's a bit of an awkward. He's like, get in your bag, get in your bloody bag. And, you know, the Merseybeat Awards go to the best couple of the year, goes to John and Yoko. There's something really not great about
it. I thought he was making... I didn't interpret that as badly as some people have. Because because the way he says, get in your bag, in a... He either does it in his exaggerated Cockney or his exaggerated Scouse voice. I can't remember. I don't think it's as pointed as some people think it is. And throughout, A, Yoko is far less intrusive than I think we've been led to believe in these sessions.
Yes.
You know, having read the books prior to seeing this footage, you're kind of led to believe that she's basically telling them to play G when they're playing D. And actually, she doesn't say anything, or very, very little. And Linda's often there, and she's often chatting to Linda. And I think that the getting your bag and the Merseybeat Couple of the Year awards, I don't know, I think he's trying to diffuse tension rather than have a go at his mates.
Yeah.
That was my personal interpretation.
Well, there's a lot of...
There's the bit when he says, you know, it's going to be ridiculous, isn't it, or comic in 50 years' time when people will say, oh, they split up because Yoko sat on an amp. I think McCartney is actually quite empathetic to how in love John is.
Yes. It's, again, reported, you know, people hear all these bootlegs have been going around for years, and there's a lot more of Yoko on the bootlegs than appeared in here, but she's not ruining anything. She's just having a conversation, you know, but it's been reported by whoever heard these tapes had the vantage of, well, what's she got to do with the Beatles?
Yeah.
Well, everything, you know, and it's been taken in that slant.
And it had only ever been George Martin, Brian Epstein and Mal, really, with them in the studio.
Yeah. But now, this is the point, oh gosh, so Martin Luther King, Michael Lindsay Hogg has a dream. He's still talking about possible locations for the show.
Oh,
George Harrison has just left the Beatles. And I think it's just one of those desperate things. Paul says, well, I don't know, the cavern. And then George Martin says, location isn't actually your main problem at the moment. And Paul says, it's breathing, actually.
Yeah.
Then this is... an astonishing part of the film. You get George's isn't it a pity, and the camera pans to Paul. He's stroking his beard, and you can see the realization in his face. And John, it cuts to John, you know, his head in his hands, and he's kind of staring at the ground. They're about to leave, and Ringo, he reaches out for Paul, and Paul seems to be comforting him. Ringo just stands there literally like a toddler. Can see his eyes watering, and John and Yoko are just to his sides, and he just stares at John, and you can see the tears coming down his eyes, and John swoops in for a hug, and they all three of them hug, and it's just wow, unbelievable.
Yeah. And I was born in 1980. So I'd kind of been led to believe that men in the 60s, certainly working class men from Liverpool, didn't really talk to each other like that in that way. And they didn't hug each other when they were visibly upset. I think that they had a more... I can't believe I'm saying this really, because I mean, you're writing off millions of people, but they're more outwardly empathetic and sympathetic to each other than I'd expected them to be, bearing in mind their backgrounds and the fact that it's January 1969. And there's the bit where, in episode two, where Paul says, and then there were two, and he's got tears in his eyes. And they, bearing in mind it's over half a century ago, as people, they don't seem that far away. Obviously, there's 60s sort of vernacular describing things as being a drag. I've never said that word in that context. they don't go as far as saying words like groovy, but you know the way they speak is there are ever so slight sort of small changes. Obviously, the Liverpool accent's changed in the last 50 years, but as people, I really felt like I knew them. And when they are faced with this potential profound life change, I mean, if George has walked out of the band, and there's that diary entry, isn't there? You know, woke up, went to Twickenham, rehearsed until lunchtime, left the Beatles, went home. If he's, and then they have the meeting, it says this, isn't it, at the end of the episode where they go around to his house to discuss it and the meeting doesn't go well. And you think, oh, yeah. And even though I know that he comes back, yes. For that split second, when that title comes up on the screen, you think, oh my God, there will be no Let It Be, there will be no Abbey Road. So it's a great bit of filmmaking because it's a great cliffhanger. But they're just under such stress. I mean, they've been in each other's pockets, you know, for sort of 7 years. And they've got this incredible deadline, having just written a double album. And they're doing everything in front of the cameras. And they're still young men doing things for the first time. Because nowadays, if you're a huge pop star, you're looked after. And you've got people in your management, and it's in their interests and it's in the record label's interests to look after their artists. And I think that's why, I mean, sadly, that is why so many of that generation of rock musician died, because they didn't have people looking after them. It's a very, very human aspect. And even if it had just, even if Peter Jackson had just shown them writing and creating and rehearsing and then eventually performing the songs, that would be brilliant. And I would watch it, of course I would. But the sort of the human soap opera aspect of certainly the end of episode one as well and start of episode two just makes it completely gripping. And even if you're one of those oddballs who doesn't like the music of the Beatles, and they do exist, I think that if you're interested in interpersonal dynamics and how bands work, and how talented people rub up against each other when they're in a room and they're under they've got a tight deadline, then I think it's a really, really interesting piece of television. You know, like the Metallica documentary is great. I don't like Metallica. I don't own a single Metallica record. But that's a really, really fascinating look at the mechanics of a group. And I think that this is the same. It just happens to be about the best band ever.
That moment, it's just profound, and it goes against everything that we've ever read about the Beatles. You know, 68, yeah, they sort of fell out, and that was it, and they gradually fell apart. But that moment, they're just all three of them together. They're mourning. It's not just mourning George. It's mourning the fact that, yeah, Ringo's already left. George has left. It ain't going to happen. And it's so moving.
Yeah.
Breaks my heart.
Yeah, and the last time they record with each other, isn't it August the 22nd, 69? I think that's the last time they're all in the studio together. So they've only got 8 months left anyway. But you do know that they eventually overcome this hurdle. But I'd always thought that they'd completely run out of road by the time they got to this period. I thought that, you know, Let It Be is the full stop, and there wasn't any more music in them. Well, that's what I'd been led to believe, obviously, as just a fan who'd read the books and had watched the anthology. I'd seen the documentaries. That was how I had been led to believe it worked. But I think there actually was more music left in them. And I've never listened to Abbey Road. You know, I've never listened to side two of Abbey Road and thought, what could have been? Because also, I think it's a very fitting end to their career, if you look at it that way around. But when you watch them, certainly in episode two and episode three, when the music's really coming together, you think, oh God, they were great. They were really great. And there's a bit in the anthology where Ringo Starr's talking about these sessions. Obviously, they filmed that in like 1994, 1995. And Ringo says, Oh, it was always good. Obviously, it was made more harmonious when Billy Preston joined the band. But also, he says that. But also, when we were working on good stuff, that always really energized us. You know, if we knew we were working on a really good track, then that always boosted our enthusiasm. And I think you really see that in episodes 2 and 3, when they're working on the songs that go on to become future Beatles classics. You can just see there's that spark of enthusiasm, which I'm assuming is the same as it was when John and Paul first met in 1957. And it's those moments. I always thought that I just had assumed that they'd been quite workmanlike to get Abbey Road and Let It Be finished. But I think that, no, I think they really enjoyed it. And it's a shame that other stuff, I think, got in the way. And you see Lennon saying, oh, you've got to meet Alan Klein. You've got to meet him. Just sort of shouting at the screen. Surely, for Ringo and for Paul, watching it back, it must be incredibly moving, I think, to have this document of yourself at that age, you know, 28 and 26 as they were, I think. And now, you know, they're old men, you know. I mean, Ringo's in his 80s. It just must be really, really quite a very profound thing, I think, to watch that kind of footage of yourself. So I've now watched Ep 1 twice. And I dread to think how many more times I'm going to watch it. But the only thing that gets in the way a little bit is that when the Beatles anthology was first on the telly and I taped it off the TV, because I was at school, I was able to just sit and watch it again and again and again. I took it with me to university. And if I was ever upset about anything, if I was ever down, I would watch that. So I really put the hours in. Whereas I'm a 41-year-old father of two now. I haven't got 8 hours to spare. I'm going to take my daughter to Brownies tomorrow night. I mean,
we'll leave her there and go and watch this. Ellis James, thank you so much. That was wonderful.
It's my pleasure.